Our guest is Captain Philip Marshall. Your book is absolutely fascinating. It really is. It's so well written. It's very articulate and it's clever and it's scary as hell. This is some amazing stuff. It's just one of those works you just want to linger over because not only is it well written, but you can't believe what you're reading.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe some of this stuff. I wanted to talk about where I got this title from. It's a Carl Sagan quote that I really love. He said, "One of the saddest lessons in history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle." I think that really tells us a lot about the whole episode of 9/11 is just getting out of control. As I explained in the book, I was studying the Bush administration for probably 10 years prior to 9/11. I was knee-deep in the BCCI scandal. I was looking into the SNL loan. I was part of the Iran-Contra affair. I didn't know it at the time. I was in the Special Activities Division, which is a real gray area for people. I think most of the people that are doing special activities for these illegal operations aren't aware that they're actually in special activities. I was knee-deep into it. I was really getting nervous when I saw that W was running for president, and then to see the way he won the election with his brother counting the deciding votes, I knew that we were in big trouble. So it didn't really surprise me. By the time I saw the third replay, I smelled a rat. The good news for anything that's done in an airliner is that it's recorded. Everything is recorded. Every sentence, every word you say in the cockpit is recorded. Every move you make with the yoke is recorded. Every transmission is recorded. I knew that at some point we would get to the bottom of this. By the time they released the NTSB reports and the black box data and all that, they had already given us this bamboozle that it was some ghost that lived in a cave on the other side of the world that had defeated our entire U.S. national security. So I started writing it back in 2005. I really started studying it then when I had all the information, and I put it together. Maybe it would have been, you know, who they said it was, but when I looked into the NTSB, when I saw the flight patterns and everything, it was very obvious to me that these guys had been trained very well. Some of them weren't even pilots when they came to the U.S., and when I found the FBI or the Congressional Inquiry Report that was headed by Senator Bob Graham, very, very interesting. As soon as I saw that report, I knew that we had found where they were trained. And when the hijackers came into Los Angeles on January the 15th of 2000 on a Thai Airways flight from Bangkok, their movements for 18 months were chronicled by FBI agents, field agents. And we could see that Saudi spies, as Senator Graham called them, were aiding these guys. They were giving them logistical support. They were giving them financial support, opening bank accounts. They followed these guys all the way until December of 2000. 80 pages worth in the Congressional Inquiry Report chronicles this. And around December of 2000 is when they went into a go mode. And the go mode was they all went out to the Arizona desert. There's a lot of documentation on that. They had FBI agents sending up warnings. Hey, we've got a bunch of Saudi guys out here learning how to fly airplanes, and I think they're trying to pull some kind of a terrorist operation. Those warnings were ignored, and we can see that there was three of the pilot hijackers. That was my focus was on the pilots.
Why don't we get into how this all got rolling? In fact, where were you? Where did you happen to be on September 11, 01?
I just finished a four-day trip. I was flying up and down the West Coast for 4 days and got home around midnight on September the 10th. So I was exhausted. I was tired. My phone started ringing at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was thinking, I'll just sleep through this one. But it just kept ringing and ringing. And then I went and checked the messages, and I got all these crazy things. Are you watching this? What in the world is this? Are you okay? I hope you're not flying New York. And I had no idea what was going on. I turned the television set on, and I saw the building on fire. The North Tower was on fire, and I couldn't believe it. It's like windows were blown out of all sides of it, black smoke coming out. And I'm thinking, what does this have to do with me? And then I saw the United 767 strafing Manhattan. It was like a wild thought. Like, what in the world? One of our pilots, is he trying to get a better view of this or what? And when he banked into that building, I just about jumped out of my skin. I could not believe it. How could this be? How could a United Airlines captain fly purposely into a building like that? And every time I watch that replay, I still jump at it. It just is so unnatural to see a suicidal attack with such a beautiful airplane. It was sad, and I started thinking about all my fellow pilots and had no idea who was in that airplane. And later on, I found out, and it's really sad. It hit our airline so hard. It hit us as employees so hard. It was very hard to see, and it hasn't gotten any better. But
no.
I vowed that day that I was going to find out who was behind this. And I can tell you that I am absolutely 100% sure I know who was behind it now. When I put together the tactical plan on this attack, there's so much evidence of aviation experts, and they knew exactly which airplanes to hijack, ones that were full of fuel going from East Coast to the West Coast. But when I put it together and saw when the airplanes pushed back from the gates, and they all pushed back on time, and they picked the perfect day, it was a beautiful weather day, there were no weather delays at all. The routes were very predictable, but the attack was designed to be done. From the time they pushed back, an hour later, those attacks needed to be done. And when you see the two planes that hit the World Trade Center, those ones were executed to perfection. They hit it just right. There was no way that there could have been a military intervention unless there just happened to be some fighters flying over the area. Where this thing really, where they get caught with their pants down is the two that were delayed. Like United 93 encountered some delays on the ground at Newark before it took off. They crossed, they were 112 miles to the north of Washington at the perfect time. And for some reason, they continued on. Whether there was confusion with the hijackers or some sort of a malfunction, I don't know why they didn't take the airplane from that point and just drive it right to D.C. Because when we look at the black box recordings, when we see the navigational frequencies that were set in, they were set in to Washington National Airport. So that tells us that that's where that airplane was intending to go. By the time they took over the airplane, they were 300 miles to the west. And that created a delay. And it seemed that everything was set up for it to be done around 9:10 at the latest. And that airplane didn't hit until 9:40. So there was 30 minutes is an eternity in aviation when you're moving at 500 miles an hour. I think that's where they really got caught. I think they were busted, basically. But no one read it. No one analyzed it. But if they would have turned in right then, and American 11 that came out of Dulles, he too went 300 miles to the west. And when the cockpit was being taken over, that was about the same time that United 175 hit the South Tower. So there was plenty of time for scrambles out of Andrews and out of Langley that should have intercepted those airplanes. So when you see the president reading the pet goat, I think what he was doing is waiting for the attack to be completed, and then they could have. Now, if they would have done it on time, he could have jumped up at 9:05 and started scrambling everything. It would have really looked like they were trying to stop it.
Is it your opinion Flight 93 was headed for the Capitol Dome?
I don't know if it was headed for the Capitol Dome. That's my guess. I do know that it was from the black box recordings where we can see where the navigational frequencies were manually entered into the navigation. We know that they were set into the localizer frequency at Washington National Airport. So we know it was heading that way. That's where they were planned to go. What happened with that flight was that obviously it was planned. That's where they should have taken it over when it was 112 miles to the north. When they ended up taking over the airplane, they were out of range for that frequency, for that localizer at National. And basically that pilot got lost out there. He didn't have anything to navigate with. He didn't have anything to hook the autopilot up with. So you can see that how he made a couple other mistakes with the autopilot. He actually got up to about 40,000 feet, which is way too high at that weight. You can get up to 40,000 in a 757, but you have to burn a lot of fuel off before you can do that. And he almost stalled the airplane out 250 miles from the target, and he ended up crashing at 112 miles from downtown Washington. There's a lot of indications that people knew that this attack was coming. I remember watching the news that day, and there was media reports saying that the Capitol was the target. I don't know how in the world anyone would know that for sure. It tells me that there's a lot of signs that people knew that it was coming. And I thought that your last guest, Susan Lindauer, I thought her explanation was, you know, when she talked about the back channels, you know, there was a lot of back channel stuff going on that was promoting this evildoer, this Osama bin Laden was getting ready to strike and all this. I think those were rumors. I think those were back channel. It was a setup for the bamboozle, basically, that they had all these reports, supposedly, that went up to the White House. And those reports kept saying that, oh, this guy bin Laden's getting ready to strike. But, you know, as an airline captain at that time, no one told me there was a threat out there. No one told Jason Dahl or anybody else that these threats were out there. So I thought it was really interesting. And when I looked into the evidence on bin Laden, you know, through the congressional inquiry who looked into it for a long time, almost a year, there's no operational evidence at all on bin Laden. They have 80 pages worth on the Saudi intelligence.
On the cover of your book is the seal of the intelligence community. Why is that seal there?
It shows. Susan mentioned the intelligence community a lot. You hear it a lot on the media, but you really don't know what it is. And I started picking up that whoever this intelligence community was, they were the ones in the reports that kept saying, oh, the intelligence community says that bin Laden is behind 9/11 because, and then there was nothing after the because, really, except for that he wrote a fatwa back in 1998. So that's the only evidence that's cited anywhere, is that he wrote a fatwa that he was going to strike the United States. So I started looking in, okay, so who is the intelligence community? We present this evidence of who the intelligence community is. They're every armed authority of the United States as a result of 9/11, as a result of the attack. They control the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, the CIA, the FBI, the energy, and the big one is the United States Treasury. They have learned how to go around our Congress and tap directly into the Treasury. And those are our tax dollars that are sitting there as the grand prize for anyone that has taken over the United States government, is that they get to the Treasury. And they control the Treasury. I think from now on, anyone who reads this book will know the rest of their life when they hear in the intelligence community what exactly that is. And it's being run from a 1.4 million square foot building called the George Bush Center of Intelligence right outside of Washington. So the way I see it is that they have overpowered our government. They have overpowered the three branches of equal power with scare tactics. We got to throw all of our money at terrorism. So $15 trillion has disappeared since the time that George W. Bush took over. They spent every penny that we sent them in our taxes and then $15 trillion on top of that. So I'm wondering, where did all that money go and who's controlling that money? It's a pattern that I was studying before that. The BCCI scandal was very fishy type. They got into the Treasury and billions of dollars disappear almost on a daily basis for the last 10 years.
So the attack was planned. Someone is going to launch this attack. One way or another, this attack is going to happen. How were these novice pilots able to fly as competently as they did? Because I couldn't jump into the left seat of any of these aircraft, take a look at the POH and do my thing. So how did these guys do this, and where did they receive their training, and who arranged that?
That was the first thing that really raised the red flag for me, was when I got the NTSB reports and saw the flight patterns and the black box recordings and all that are very, very accurate. And they all lined up to the half second with everything. So I put that together. I've got all the black box recordings so people can see. They can go in there and look at it, especially when airline pilots look at this thing, they go, holy smoke, how in the world did they know how to do that? So it's very obvious to me that they had a Boeing instructor and Boeing airplane. There was no doubt about that. For instance, I tried to fly the pattern of American 77, the one that hit the Pentagon, and I flew it 300 miles to the west is where this Hani Hanjour, who was the pilot, he was a Saudi guy from the same hometown as the Prince Bandar, who was documented as funding this operation through the Riggs Bank. He took the airplane from 300 miles west, made the perfect turnaround. Of course, that was a pretty easy one there because he was going west. So all he had to do is reverse course for his navigation. So then he came back into Washington. He came over Dulles Airport around 9,000 feet. He clicked the autopilot off at 7,000 feet, and you can see he kind of waved it a little bit. But that's to be, I mean, I can't imagine flying that airplane single pilot. You know, I rely on my co-pilot. You know, you're basically a two-headed, four-armed monster in the cockpit of one of those airliners, and you're checking and cross-checking, and we have all types of procedures that we're watching each other. You can't, almost doesn't cut it in the airline business. You know, oh, I almost got to 7,000 feet. I leveled off at 6,000. Yeah, well, that's great, but you just killed 500 people. It doesn't cut it. But at any rate, he clicked off the autopilot at 7,000 feet and coming right at the Pentagon. He, too, had National Airport locked in on his navigation. So on a beautiful day like that, he could pick up the target visually. And when he did that, he came over the Pentagon. He was way high. He was at 7,000 feet. And the Pentagon's not that easy to spot, really, from the air. It's kind of a spread-out building, and there's a lot of other buildings in the area. You really have to know what you're looking for. Now, he came down 7,000 feet, and he did a steep descending turn and rolled out at 2,500 feet with the Pentagon in the windshield in front of him. Now, think about what was going on at that time. They just killed two pilots. It was a murder scene. It was chaos. It was, I can't even imagine trying to stay focused in a situation like that. But this guy had the situational awareness to roll out at 2,500 feet and started diving towards the Pentagon. And then he pushed the throttles up to the firewall. Now, when I tried that in the simulator, you know, I'm a pretty big guy. I'm 220 pounds, 6'3", 220, something like that. I could not hold the yoke down because those engines produce something like 60,000 pounds of thrust each. So that thing's climbing like a bat out of hell. So the only way, so I actually missed it on the first, I was 1,000 feet and climbing when I went over it the first time in the sim. It took me four tries to hit the building. And the only way I could do that was to start trimming the nose down before I pushed the throttles up. So according to the official intelligence community, this was this guy's first time in the cockpit of a 757.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think so. So that leads me to believe that, hey, somebody trained him. Can I find any evidence that someone trained them? Well, when I found the Congressional Joint Inquiry Report and learned that as soon as these guys hit the ground in Los Angeles on January 15th, they were met by employees of the Saudi Aviation Authority. And they were connected to a company called Dala Avco, which is a Saudi operator, kind of a contractor for the Saudi government that operates Boeing airplanes. So that tells me right there, it's like, oh, there it is. I found where they got instructors from, and I found out where they got the manuals from and the expertise that was needed to fly this particular mission. My next step was, okay, now I need to find an airport, and I need to find airplanes. And all the reports, the FBI guys were following these guys out into this triangle out in Arizona. And I started looking around out there for, they have these storage airports. The banks own most of the airplanes that are leased by the airlines. And sometimes in between these leases, they're parked at these storage airports. And one airport really started to stick out. It had 757s and 767s parked on the field in the summer of 2001. And it was a CIA airport from back in the Air America days. So that started to raise some red flags. And then on top of that, there was number three guy at the CIA who was appointed by W in June of 2001. His firm was the one that was placing all these trades on the airlines that went down. He had put options on two airlines, or he didn't, but his firm did. So there was a connection there. Jeremy Scahill is a investigative author that wrote extensively about Pinal Air Base out there. And that's where these guys disappeared to. That's where they were. That's where the FBI reported seeing them out in the Arizona desert. And at the same time, the head of the Saudi intelligence, the longtime guy, Prince Turki Al-Fazl, was in the area. He was up in Las Vegas. He was in the same desert about 100 guys that disappeared, or they flew out about a week after the attack.
Maybe you would like to elaborate a little bit on how you knew that was a spook airport. Quoting from the Big Bamboozle, a silent, confounding shift went unnoticed by most American voters. While Ronald Reagan gave great speeches with positive messages, accented with humor and perhaps the best timing of any politician in U.S. history, Bush and Baker slipped into the White House basement to build a covert government with CIA, DEA, and black ops assets. Today, this operation is called the Intelligence Community. And I still want to know how Captain Philip Marshall knew that was a spook airport, and he's going to tell us about it. Tell us just briefly your background and why you would recognize a spook airport when you saw one.
I have some connections that remain in the spook world. There's a lot of contractors out there. Blackwater is one of them. There's quite a few other operations that are, so I was getting information from, it's a pretty tight circle. Aviation's a pretty tight circle in itself, but this particular strain of pilot, we keep in touch, let's just put it that way. And I started getting hints of this Pinal Air Base from about three guys that work in that field. I have to be very careful about that because they still provide information to me. When I started hearing about what was going on, I actually took a little trip out there to, it's just north of Tucson in a little town called Marana, Arizona. You can see it on Google Earth. You can spot it. Even then, it's very, very hard to spot. But there's this airport out in the middle of nowhere. It's a triangular airport that has three runways on it. And there's about 100 airliners there in storage right now. They're cannibalized if they're there for a while in the lucrative parts market. You know, but they're still airworthy airplanes that are ready to go. They're just in between leases. So I took a little trip out there. And I can tell you they've got some big rattlesnakes on the south end of that airport. At any rate, I did a little investigating of my own out there, and I looked around. One day I went out there, and I saw that there was 5 747s. This is a county-owned airport, and they wouldn't let me on the airport. They had a Evergreen International is one of the famous spook contractors, but they wouldn't let me pass the guard gate. I just act like I was an aviation enthusiast, just wanted to take pictures or whatever. So I talked to a couple of people around the airport that live around the airport, and they were telling me that many times people are trying to take pictures of that airport, and they'll send a car out there and confiscate the camera and all kinds of bad activities like that. But when I was out there, what I saw was, this was in about 06, 07, and there was 747s cargo that were being loaded up. And I have no idea where they were going. There was all types of Black Hawk helicopters flying around. It looked like LaGuardia Airport. There was so much traffic out there in the middle of the desert. The 757s and 767s were parked there. We have pictures of them. That's on our Facebook. We have a bunch of videos on Facebook that I think are really good. The Big Bamboozle is the page on that. And there's quite a good history. If you go online, you can see, if you Google it, you can see, look up the Pinal, P-I-N-A-L, Air Park. It's well known as a long-time CIA-operated airport. There's a lot of controversy about trying to shut it down years ago. People that are on the board of directors are CIA people. So it has a long connection all the way back to, like I said, Air America.
All right, then. This is such a convoluted deal, isn't it? It's just so ridiculous. So let me just fire the proverbial shotgun out the back door. Why was this done? Who financed it? And who's the king rat who orchestrated all of this? I never thought it was a very good idea to have the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency become president. And it appears that the intelligence community is morphing into one great big American-style KGB. But that's just me and probably a few million other people. So you think Bush and Cheney were involved in this up to their necks? And I'll go out on the clothesline first, Philip, and I'll just tell you that I thought it was odd. I can tell you that if I were president of the United States and I got a message that something just hit the fan so hard that it busted off all the blades and stripped the spindle out of the fan motor, I'd have said, children, I have to go. I have to go back to work. Something's come up, and I need to go, but we'll get back to the pet goat. I'll come back and see you, but I need to go right now. And I'd have been out the door. But again, that's just me. And as his presidency went on, I thought his behavior became increasingly more odd. I found that as time went on, he was less articulate, the answers were more convoluted, and the facts became more obscured.
When we put the timing on the attack together, and we see who knew what and when they knew it, the FAA knew about 35 minutes before the airplane hit the North Tower. American 11 came out of Boston. The FAA was following these guys all of a sudden the transponder went off and this thing makes a beeline towards Manhattan. So there was teleconferences going on between Boston and New York, FAA headquarters. They were well aware that this airplane had been hijacked. And on top of that, Muhammad Atta, who was flying American 11, thought he was talking to the passengers at one point. And he was actually talking to ATC, which air traffic control, and everything's recorded. He basically said, everybody, don't make any stupid moves and things like that. The controllers that were working that flight knew right away that this thing was a hijack. And they started calling people left and right. When I put the times together, when all these calls were made, Condoleezza Rice, who's Steve Pasesnik, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a real interesting insider with the State Department. He said it was a false flag operation, that Condoleezza Rice was part of it. So I do concur with that, because when she had a telephone conversation with Bush at 8:55 after the American 11 had hit the North Tower, and in that conversation, she was talking to him and said, all we know is that it was a twin-engine airplane that crashed into the North Tower. The only way she would have known that, and technically that's true, but if you say, oh, it's a twin-engine airplane, you're thinking a smaller, lighter plane type thing. 767 is a twin-engine airplane, but it weighs 300,000 pounds. For her to know that it was a twin-engine airplane, the only way she would have known that was because the FAA told her that, unless she had an eyewitness that just happened to be in downtown Manhattan and say, oh, you look like a twin-engine airplane to me. It makes no sense. Finally, they got her to testify in 2004. Of course, the media had already convicted the ghost. But at any rate, if you think about it, the only way she would have known it was a twin-engine airplane was from the FAA. And the only reason they were talking about that airplane was because they knew it was a hijack. So again, there's a just pants down type thing. There's no way she could have known that. And that's before he went into the classroom. He sat there until 9:02, fidgeting, looking around, and looked like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. And then when the second one hit, what he needed to hear was that the attack was complete, and all he heard was that two had hit. So he had to stall. He had to wait. They must have been nervous. Whoever was behind this must have been sweating bullets at this point, because two of them had hit and two of them were missing at that point, and probably they didn't know where the other two were. So that, to me, tells me that there's something stinky about it. And before, too, with the 23 supposed PDBs that were sent up to the president, and he didn't take any action. He didn't alert airline pilots. He didn't alert anyone. It just stinks. And I don't think anyone's ever, I think there was one reporter that asked him, hey, were you behind this? No one's ever asked him that directly, except for that time. And he just looked like a deer caught in the headlights when they asked him that question. It's online. I've seen it a few times. But it's almost funny the way he didn't know what to say.
Who financed this? What are the indications from your research?
Well, again, the Congressional Joint Inquiry followed the financing that went to the hijackers. There was a Riggs Bank account in Washington, D.C. that Prince Bandar bin Sultan, you know, the good friend of, they call him Bandar Bush, he's so tight with the Bush family. He opened an account, and his wife had an account, and the Congressional Inquiry said there was unlimited funding from Saudi Arabia. The guy that met him in Los Angeles a couple of days after the hijackers arrived had seemingly unlimited financing from Saudi Arabia. That's a quote from their report.
Unlimited financing.
Unlimited. Seemingly unlimited financing from Saudi Arabia.
What's in it for the Saudis to cause this to be a part of a problem of this magnitude? We note that some people made some money shorting some airline stocks. There were some curious dealings on Wall Street prior to this attack. And you know, the Saudis are so enigmatic. Most of the population lives in squalor, and then there's the select few that does well. What's in it for the Saudis for us to go to war with Iraq to the point where they would provide unlimited financing for this attack?
There's definitely a thread in all of this stuff that makes its way to Saudi Arabia. And before 9/11, I was studying this relationship between the Bush family and the Saudi government. They were definitely involved in the BCCI scandal. They were definitely involved in the other covert operation from the Reagan-Bush administration, which was the Iran-Contra financing. So there's an alliance there somewhere. It's power. It's definitely something to do with a lot of power. If you've got control of the oil markets, and it just falls into that area. It's very obvious that they were involved in this one, and they were involved in the other two that I mentioned earlier. It's absolute power is what they have over there, and absolute power is what the intelligence community is working on right now. And they're trying to outpower our congressional, our judicial branch, and the executive branch. We've had the president, Obama, has stated many times that he wants to prosecute this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that's down there in Guantanamo. And right next to him is the attorney general. So there you have two of the three branches right there that want to prosecute him. But for some reason, and they announced that they were going to have the trial in New York a couple of years ago. And I've been watching it really close, and I still can't tell you how that got derailed. But it's an absolute power type thing.
Closing Guantanamo Bay and dragging all those people into civilian court might not be the best idea, you think? Because they might sing about who's actually behind this.
Absolutely. You're a pilot. You understand situational awareness. You have to realize how you got into a situation to figure your way out of it.
Yes.
If we use the judicial system like Obama promised in his campaign in 2008, because I realized in 2005 that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had nothing. He has no aviation expertise. You're trying to tell us that this guy is the one that found holes in the U.S. military air defenses? That would really be embarrassing to some of these Air Force generals that have gone to military school all these years, that this guy figured out, oh, this is how we can penetrate the U.S. air defenses. It's impossible. It's a big bamboozle. So if this guy came to trial, the lid would be blown off of this thing. And it would change Washington. And I think that if you brought this guy, you would see a lot of corporate jets flying nonstop to Argentina.
How were these pilots able to have so much time without running into some fighters? What was up with that?
If the attack would have been executed the way I believe it was drawn up, where these guys would take off in the first 15 minutes, got to altitude, and then just shot right to their targets. It was a good tactical plan. Two of them hit on plan. The other two delayed for almost another hour. It's very interesting that there was a competent response from the military at first. They launched two F-15s out of Otis Air Force Base out in Cape Cod, but they wouldn't have made it there. They didn't make it in time. So I think it's really suspicious that when the attack started to encounter delays, that all of a sudden there was a, seems like a military stand down until it got completed. And when we go back and look at what Dick Cheney was running the response from the White House, it becomes very apparent that what he told the country on, there was a Meet the Press on that next Sunday, and he said that they launched more fighters and that they ordered a shoot down. But when we checked that, and more specifically when Jeremy Scahill checked that, and Philip Sheehan, who wrote the commission, there were seven logs that's taken on those conversations between Cheney and Bush, and none of them mention a shoot-down order or even a scramble. So I thought this guy, Steve Pasednik, that came out after the Bin Laden, that crazy raid that they supposedly killed him, he came out and said that he used to teach that at military school, that stand-down. So it seems to me there was a very obvious stand-down. And then as soon as they got the word that United 93 crashed, and that was the fourth one, then they launched some fighters. But when they got over there, only smoke was in the sky at that point. Everything else was done. So it's a really very suspicious that for that hour, we couldn't get one fighter airborne.
I got another question that's been dogging me for a long time, and that's the absence of debris at the Pentagon. You know, I'm sure you've heard all these theories on it actually being having been hit by a missile rather than an aircraft. Do you subscribe to any of these theories, or are you convinced it was an aircraft? And if so, how come so little debris?
When you look at the pictures, there's a fairing, there's some pieces out in front of the Pentagon right after the crash. There's a wing fairing that's out there laying in front. But this thing hit at 482 knots indicated, which is about 530 miles per hour. And I've heard people say, well, the hole's not big enough. Well, you had a fortified west wing of the Pentagon, and the wings are pretty light. You're talking about aluminum wings, so they didn't withstand a hit on the west wall. I've talked to controllers at Washington National. They saw the airplane. They got a visual on it. I've talked to the lead investigator at FAA, and I don't think there's any question. I think that that was probably part of the psych ops that was floating bad information about that. But people thought it was a missile because the airplane was flying so fast. Normally, if you're in Washington, you'll see airplanes going down the Potomac, and they're slowed down to like 140 knots. This airplane was doing four times that speed. So it probably looked like a missile. It probably sounded like a missile, and it was a missile. It was a 757 missile. But I don't think there's any question. The radar shows it. The black boxes show it. So I think that was probably something to distract us. I think it was propaganda.
You know, some of us just don't know when to stop. I certainly don't. Perhaps someone will have to do that for me. But this whole bloody thing, quite literally, I don't know how to get my mind around this. Do I believe that my government would turn on the people like that? I don't want to think so. But do I think that 3,000 people in the World Trade Center buildings could be sacrificed toward the further goal of locking the whole thing down under some sort of an ever-encroaching police state? Yes, I do. Soldiers and civilians have been sacrificed before. As a matter of fact, when the Allies captured the Enigma decoding machine back in World War II, they had to, I think it was it Coventry that got hit so badly? It was terrible. Thousands of people were lost. But if we had done anything to thwart that attack, it would have tipped off the Germans that we had their machine. So we just let it go. Do you sense that there is an encroaching police state and that this is just one in a series of false flag attacks that are designed to bring about a totalitarian regime, at least in contrast to what we've grown up with or what we thought we had?
I have my opinions about that, but to tell you the truth, I am not an expert in that area. My message really is that this was a Saudi operation that was probably covered by our Special Activities Division. But when you put it together and you see who is given this fable about bin Laden and all that, those are the same people who are developing the DHS and the TSA. Supposedly some guy in a cave attacked us, but grandma going through security at Des Moines Airport is getting shaken down. And it's troubling to see this systematic takeover of the government. And I don't know what the big picture is. I don't know what they saw down the road that may have been a bigger number, that may have been leading to something bigger that they stopped. I don't know why this attack led us to go invade Iraq, other than it was written in a, I don't know if you're familiar with the Project for a New American Century, but that's one of my pieces of evidence that's on our evidence sources. That plan that they came up with, it was a theoretical attack. They called it a new Pearl Harbor, and that would help America get into a war mentality. And it just seems that that plan, if you look at it now, 11 years later, is the same thing that's happened. It's actually transpired exactly like that. They talk about using Predator drones and Blackwater-type mercenary armies. And it's so encompassing now because what it's done is given this great authority, this fear of an enemy that I don't really think is there. And it's given them a lot of power. There's a lot of hysteria involved when you go to the airport now. You know, they're telling you, look at your neighbor, look around, see who looks suspicious. We got everybody looking at each other, and now they're looking into our lives. And everything's being coordinated with DHS and the DMV now out here. It's very suspicious that it's the very same people that are telling us that it was a terrorist attack. They're the same people that are clamping down, and their power has gone up so much. So I think it's a big plan. You know, when you read that Project for a New American Century, they talk about Dick Cheney as being their inspirational leader. Those types are now the ones that are really in control of what's going on. So they don't really need to have an election anymore if they have power over our three branches of government.
It really does look like it's morphing into one big KGB. It really does look that way. In fact, I saw a silver gray Ford police car looking thing, like the one the feds drive around, everybody driving in that business. And it had an interesting, very official federal looking seal on the door. And it said, Veterans Securing America. And there were a couple of young guys there, so they were coming out of this gas station. I spoke with them for a minute and said, say, fellas, I've never seen a plaque like that. What department are you with? Are you Homeland Security? No, they're just young veterans that just finished up with a couple of tours. One of them had been in for 5 years, another one for double, and they had been to the Middle East twice, and now they were just securing whatever federal facilities they were asked to secure. They weren't really very specific, but I got these were fit, fresh soldiers. Now, they got themselves a federal job, and I'm like, is there just no end? Maybe I just don't get around much, but I never saw a veteran securing America before. on the side of any federal-looking car. And I'm starting to see Federal Protective Services, Department of Homeland Security, the big suburban-looking machines with increasing frequency. I spoke with one of them, and he said, oh, no, we're basically security guards for federal properties. Could be anything. But there just seems to be no end to it. And I understand, going back to that drone thing, I understand that in the next few years we're going to have 30,000 of them, and there have been over 200 applications to fly these things just in the last year. So I don't really know where it's all headed. I'm not sure I want to know, but I feel like I need to know, and I feel like the American people need to know. And I don't want to turn this into a scare fest or anything, but this is getting just a little bit freaky. I mean, the Russians were over there for 9 years, and then we go over there for 9 years, and it's no parade. St. Louis did it. New York turned it down, and now we're gearing up for Iran. And could the simple fact of the matter be that we've been on a wartime economy ever since World War II, and without a war, we don't have an economy? Is that even possible?
The DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, there's a building going up in Washington right now that's been estimated at $3.2 billion. There was a great series in the Washington Post last year. Dana Priest and William Arkin are two journalists that work for the Post, and they had a four-part series called Top Secret America, where they went into how the DHS is now hooking into all the counties around, and they have these devices that they can put on the side of the road where they can read license plates and tell you how much money you have in your bank account every time you go past them. They automatically can read your license plate and get all your information. The satellite systems that are circling the globe right now are all hooked into this, the GPSs. You really don't have any security when you have so many people that have access to your personal whereabouts. If there were so many bad guys out there, maybe they're anticipating some kind of a financial meltdown or something. I don't know. I'm from New Orleans originally, and it was really frightening to hear about the Blackwater guys that were on the ground in New Orleans, you know, after Katrina. There's definitely a movement going on. It seems like they're preparing for something. They're definitely hooking into the counties, local police departments. It's going to be one big federal eye watching us when we should be watching them.
Do you get the sense that it's too big, too screwed up, and too far down the road to stop it? Or do you believe that it can be stopped? More to the point, this is just beyond anything that I thought was even possible, but have we just drunk so much fluoride and chlorine and just watched so much stuff we shouldn't be watching on the internet and so forth that we've just been asleep at the switch the whole time, and now we finally come out of the fog and it's like, oh, wow, who are you guys? Gee, they're all wearing the same uniforms. What happened? Is there any way to correct this? Or are we just going to have to ride it out all the way to the bottom?
What really amazes me is that there's so many people who have come forward. Senator Bob Graham, who was the chairman of the first federal investigation, has written two books with the message that 9/11 was a Saudi operation. Thomas Keene, the head of the 9/11 Commission, and his co-chair, Lee Hamilton, they wrote a book that said that there was a big cover-up and an obstruction of justice, especially when they were trying to interrogate Khalid Sheikh Mohammed down there. The 9/11 Commission's general counsel, John Farmer, wrote a book that said that everything that was told to the commission by the Bush administration was inexplicably and almost entirely untrue. Steve Posednik, the guy that worked in the State Department, real insider there.
Let's talk about the man who I personally feel is Susan Lindauer. Earlier felt like she had, Bin Laden was killed in Tora Bora, and there was no mention of a dialysis machine sitting around on the SEAL raid that took him out. I just wonder if, I mean, we know he was the leader of the Mujahideen when the Afghanis were fighting the Russians. So I'm just wondering if he got a nice check, dyed his hair blonde, got a trim, a nice suit, and is now retired. So who conducted the raid that supposedly captured Osama bin Laden? And why didn't the American media raise more questions about that raid if he's supposed to be the great perpetrator? Seems like he would have had a lot to say about the whole apparatus. But then again, some people have come to the conclusion that there is no Al-Qaeda. That's the boogeyman. It doesn't really exist. Do you have some thoughts on this?
That raid was very questionable on a lot of levels. First of all, I don't think that any American soldier would take an order to shoot an unarmed man in front of his family or whatever. I thought that would be a great opportunity for us to demonstrate to the world our justice system. All of these videotapes that have come up over the years, they don't add up. His appearance changed. There's one in particular that we have posted where he's walking with a supposedly militiaman. It's a BBC piece that we repeated on the Facebook page. And it's very interesting. He's supposed to be 6'7", real tall guy. But in this picture, it's the same guy that was doing the videos. And unless everyone in that militia group is 6'7", this guy, it doesn't add up. It just doesn't add up. And no one has seen him. The president of Pakistan said many years ago that he was dead. His obituary was published in Egyptian papers and Pakistani papers back in 2001. So it looked like he died. And according to Steve Pasesnik, said that he had Marfan syndrome, which is fatal. You don't live through that one. Way back in 2000 when he saw him in a hospital in Dubai. If you're on a dialysis machine, like he was reported back in 2000, you need sterile water, you need electricity. It's just no one saw the guy. No one saw him really for 10 years. And even after these videos came out, when you listen to Bush administration officials, they say, well, we haven't heard from this guy in quite some time. Well, supposedly he just made a video the month before that, and they're saying that. So that doesn't add up. So no one's seen this guy for 10 years. And then all of a sudden we get this announcement. Oh, yeah, we went in there, we found him, we killed him, and we threw him in the sea. Believe us.
Yeah.
And then, well, we can't show you the pictures because it's just too gruesome to show you these pictures. But if you're watching this carefully, like, I've really been paying attention to that raid, because in my first book about 9/11, False Flag 9/11, we came to the conclusion that he had died in December of 2001. And a lot of people have echoed that belief. So if you're conducting a reconnaissance on that compound, like they said, for 2 months prior to the supposed raid, where's the reconnaissance photos? We could bear to see that, couldn't we? You know, if you have a picture of him, supposedly there was a lot of propaganda that was sent out that he was called the pacer, that he would go out in the compound and walk and just pace back and forth. Where's the pictures? We could stomach that, couldn't we?
You would think so. As far as Bin Laden's concerned, the guy, look, the last photograph I saw of him, he looked 90. Yeah. You know what I mean? He looked decrepit. It didn't really even look like him. It looked like somebody who was sort of dressed up like him, almost like an Elvis impersonator.
Yeah, well, look on our Facebook page, the Big Bamboozle Facebook page that we have. We have a BBC, another piece of the BBC, where they actually went in there and started asking citizens of that town what they thought of it. And they were just laughing and saying, the guy that they showed was Abraham or somebody that they knew, and it wasn't Bin Laden. And none of his neighbors had seen him for the whole time. There's not one picture of the guy, except for that one that supposedly he's sitting there watching himself on TV. There's no voice recording of him. There's no record at all of him. Okay, so we found him last night and we took care of him. We threw him in the sea. Believe us. And we'll make the announcement and just believe us. But it's the same group that did this raid, is the same group that captured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan, the same group that brought him to Guantanamo, the same group that through third-hand testimony, he confessed, supposedly. That same thread of this little special activities group. We're supposed to just believe whatever they tell us with no backup. I think the biggest thing would be, where's the reconnaissance photos? If he's out there pacing all these hours in the backyard, where are those pictures?
Talk to us about the funny money moves that were made prior to the 9/11 attacks. Let's talk about the money. What do you know about any of the stocks that were shorted, any of the put options, any of the money that went uncollected? I understand there's several million dollars sitting in a bank account that still hadn't been withdrawn. And can you enlighten us on this particular facet?
We know, and I cited a lot of experts in the book about how there was alarm bells going off on September 10th and all these trades that were executed in the week prior to the attack. And then your last guest, Susan Landau, said that through a back channel in the CIA, that there was a rumor that this attack was going down. There's a chapter in the Big Bamboozle that talks about the setup, all these fake reports that said that this guy Bin Laden, my favorite title of those was that it's real, that Osama Bin Laden is real. There were a lot of people that knew this thing was coming down in a certain circle, and I'm positive that Fox News, News Corporation, they knew it was coming down. They were ready with all these crazy stories. And to find a rush to judgment happened so fast. Oh, this is the guy because we have all these reports. And those reports started to surface at the same time that the Saudis were getting ready to attack. When their flight training was ending completion, all these reports started coming up. So while they were getting ready on one side, the other side, the psychops, they were preparing this ghost that came out of nowhere and defeated the entire United States military and all of our national security measures. So there were a lot of people that knew this was coming down. And we can talk about this all night. We can talk about it for the next 10 years. But the answer is very simple, and it's our founding fathers anticipated that someone was going to try to take over our government, that they were going to try to get an absolute power going. And they left us with the tools that are still here to be a democracy. All we have to do is use it, and it's very simple. Get it into the court system. If you get it into the court system and you can start with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, bring it in there, now you open it up, and then we can go in and find all these experts that said, okay, there was a stock trade here. Where did that money go? Why didn't we track that down? All those trades could be tracked down. But if you have a Justice Department that's under the intelligence community, they're pretty much handcuffed. They're not going to do anything about it. So it's back to us. If we want a democracy, if we want to live by the Constitution, it's our duty. And the voices are starting to come forward now. And there's a lot of them. There's so many great witnesses that are available for a trial right now. It would be very entertaining to see this come down. But really, that was covered by the founding fathers. They anticipated this type of a takeover, and they gave us tools to fight it, and they're still there, and all we have to do is demand it.
Is the news media just bought and paid for by the government-controlled propaganda engine now? They just took Judge Napolitano and his Freedom Watch off Fox News. You see the writing on the wall here? I do.
Yeah, well, I think they kind of set the pace at the beginning when Dan Rather came up with about the National Guard issue with Bush early in his presidency. The information was right on, but it was like a guillotine. They took the top guy and chopped his head off and said, who's next? Anybody else want to bring up these type of things? And I've talked to a lot of reporters from major newspapers, and they don't doubt one bit what we've come up with. And there's so much to back it up, but they've told me, look, our newspaper will not publish this. This is off limits. And hopefully the piece that I'm providing for everyone is how they executed the attack and who executed it and all these other people that are circling around it. That's why I wrote the book, so they could take that piece and put it in and continue on with it. But definitely, especially the major networks are getting their pipeline of information through a real small tube. And whatever CBS gets, NBC gets, and Fox gets, it's the same story. It's from unofficial sources and can't tell you who told us this. You know, people believe that. They believe that whatever comes over NBC is gospel. But when we check it, it makes no sense at all. At the end of the book, I cite some examples. One was they were showing a graphic of a guy that had a bomb in his leg. And they said, oh, our sources tell us that Al-Qaeda has come up with this new way of implanting bombs inside of your leg. And that scares the heck out of everybody. What kind of a search would you have to do on somebody to ensure that everyone in the world who's boarded an airplane doesn't have a bomb in their leg, implanted in their leg? I mean, how much damage would that do anyway?
We can't profile anybody, so we just scrutinize everybody.
I hope that this book will hit people in the media and people in the intelligence community who aren't at the very top. You know, it's like the FBI thing. All these field agents, they came up with all this great information, all this great evidence, but when it got to the top, it was like bottle capped in. And it's a bottle cap from the top on this entire 9/11. There's people in the middle that have to know the truth, and the people in the media that are a little bit lower down than the producers. I would love to have a trial and see where they got these tapes from bin Laden. Where exactly did they come from?
Yeah, they just show up in the mail one day. That's a good point. Just quickly going back to this Dan Rather thing, when he ripped his britches with everybody, wasn't it shown, was it contrived, or was it true that the information that he had presented about former President Bush was inaccurate and contrived? In other words, was the information contrived, or was the revelation that the information was contrived? Was that part contrived?
The best I could make out of that one was that his source told him that this was the truth. When they checked it, when the rest of the media went in there to affirm what he had said, he changed his story. Made him look like an idiot.
We got Rick in Hollywood.
Hey, guys. Hey. Listen, first of all, the Bush family was involved in robbing this election in this country. So They got a favor from the Saudi Arabians to reestablish their name, because if you remember, even in Europe and around the world, the Bush family's name was indeed crap. That was the favor of 9/11. Those buildings had to come down because they were damaged from the basement. They were red tagged. Second of all, if the Saudi Arabians, like you're saying, are behind 9/11, why aren't we bombing them?
That's a good question. Thanks, Rick. Well, what you think, Captain? Why aren't we bombing them anyway? I'm just curious, what is it that we owe these guys?
If the truth comes out and Senator Graham has said that the stuff that they classified in his report would really make it clear, that's for our country to decide how to react to that. All I'm doing is bringing out the evidence that has been published and is available. It's for someone else to decide. It's for us to decide how do we deal with this. And that's why we have a Congress. But I believe our Congress has been bought and paid for, unfortunately. That's where the problem lies.
What else can people do to bring justice to this travesty? What can they do?
The first thing is awareness. You have to be aware of what the problem is and where it lies. I wrote this book so that people could read it in 2 hours, or they could take a month and look at all the links and all the footnotes and everything. And then I just finished writing the book now. We're going to try to push this into the right hands, into Washington, try to get some awareness of what the problem is, that this bin Laden stuff, anytime that his name is mentioned, red flags should go up in everyone's head and start listening really closely to what they're saying. And I promise you, you'll find that there's nothing verifiable about him being involved. So you have to be aware of what's going on. You have to know who was really behind it. And then we have to push together. And I'm going to dedicate maybe the next 5 years, 10 years, whatever. I don't know how long it's going to take. But we need to get this into the court system. That needs to be the one solid message. Get this into the court system. I think the fastest way to do it is to get KSM. He's still alive. He's only 90 miles away from our border. We don't have to bring it to New York. We can bring it to any court in the U.S. and get it under subpoena. And people like Occupy Wall Street and Occupy, you know, good for them. These people are actually doing something, and they need support. They need more people to get behind them and demonstrate and talk to your congressmen and hope that they're not too corrupted. It's just a steady message. Get this thing into the court system. And I believe that Obama and Holder, I believe that those two guys are still trying to get this into the court system, and they're being opposed by the same people that I suspect, and that's Joseph Lieberman, Lindsey Graham,
McCain,
Peter King, those guys, you know, those are the ones that we need to just keep a good eye on those guys.
Let's talk to Mike very quickly in Livermore, California.
Mr. Marshall, I think the major block for a lot of people that can't get behind any of these things with 9/11 is that they just don't see the big picture. And the big picture is it all points to the Council on Foreign Relations and the tentacles they have out there and the control they have out there. And there's an excellent DVD documentary called True Lies by Servando Gonzalez, a Cuban patriot who came over in the early 60s. It really goes through the whole history of this CFR. And I was just wondering if you have looked into any connections with the people that were involved in this, as you see, the ones in the military and in the administration and everything else. How many of them are members of the Council on Foreign Relations?
Yeah, definitely. I have read some of their stuff. It's interesting that you bring up the Cuban thing, because a lot of this intelligence community, special activities and all this stuff, it all generated, it all began around the Cuban crisis, the Cuban revolution and all that. There's a lot of offspring from that. Steve Posesnik is one of those guys. The guy that I worked with, Barry Seal, was one of those guys. Lee Harvey Oswald, that whole group, that a lot of shady stuff going on that started in the 60s with the Cubans and with that foreign council. And again, that's another thing that can be brought up in the courts, where we can talk about this forever, but until you get it in court and you get people that can testify under oath, that's where we're going to get the answers, and that's how we're going to get to the end of this thing.
Ben Franklin was asked, "What have you given us?" His response was, "A republic, if you can keep it. Be well."